Two Dimension Podcast, episode 53.
That is kind of cool, Don, actually. And yes, we are on, so start talking, dude.
I'm Don Moore, and you're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast with no direction. And with me on the opposite side is the man who will not wear a seatbelt,
yeah,
has limited letters in his name, and it repeats, Mr. Al Val.
Al Dr. Morbius from Parts Unknown Val himself.
You know, when I first found Google back in the early 90s, I was amazed at just how quick you can get information, type in all kinds of obscure stuff, and just countless things point up. Nevertheless, algorithms on a search engine pales compared to the incredible knowledge of my friend Al.
Yeah, I'm just lying, dude. I'm lying through my teeth. Research everything I say, and you'll find fakery and fallacy, but I pretend like I mean it, and it's true.
It doesn't matter what kind of obscure thing I barely remember from my childhood, if it's a movie, comic strip, cereal toy, Italian actress,
punk rock,
any kind of rock band, magazines, comic book, cartoonist. I barely remember. I just have one or two little clues. I mention it. Nobody in my entire life remembers these things and look at me and scratches the head like I'm strange. You say it to Al. He has the movie. He has the comic. He probably met the cartoonist. He's an unlimited fountain of knowledge.
Wow. Okay. After that intro, I'm gonna go now. So okay, go ahead, Don. Finish the show up or whatever. I'm not gonna make a fool of myself and go like, huh? What? I didn't know that.
But besides not wearing the seatbelt problem,
yeah, well,
I've got another one, and that is Al will not blow his own horn. You know, he remains an enigma. If you ever read these comics like The Shadow, Batman, Clark,
yeah,
and Superman, you always wonder how these guys keep their secret identity. If you know Al, you'll learn. Because you can imagine my shock this morning when I learned that my friend, my podcast brother, was being interviewed on something called Slice Radio.
Slice Radio,
so
yeah.
So tell me about that, since I knew nothing about it till it went online.
Okay, well, our other... sister, brother, podcast, Slow Robot, is on Slice Radio.
Yes.
And the program director, Daniel Pritchard, we've talked to him before, really nice guy. Out of the blue this week, he just sends me an email, and I'm like, oh, that's Daniel Pritchard, okay. And he goes, can I interview you this week? And I go, sure, you know. So we picked Thursday. So Thursday night, I opened up a Skype account. So, you know, I got a Skype account again, and you know, we just started talking about comics and, you know, because I guess he's a big comic book fan, which I didn't know.
Well, he was talking on the interview that he did like them, and I think he said when he turned a certain age, he stopped, and then he came, I think he said 19, and he,
yeah,
came back to 27.
Yeah, everybody does that, I think, you,
yeah,
know, for a little while anyway, you know.
I never did.
It's like the mob. You go away and they grab you back in or whatever that phrase is anyway. So, yeah, so we got to talking and we did a little interview. I didn't know it was going to be on. But that's cool, and then, you know, there could be some interesting news about our podcast in the future in Slice Radio.
God help.
We shall see.
It was really nice.
Yeah,
really
it was nice. Yeah, it was.
And they have a lot of diversity on Slice Radio, I was looking at.
I think they're going more towards talk now. They had a lot of music on there, but I think he wants to go heavily into talk radio. So.
Well, I think he's a musician as well. Isn't,
yeah, he?
He
said he's a musician. I've never heard his music, but, you know, I'd like to.
You should ask him.
I will ask him, yeah. So.
Yeah, because we're not limited to local bands.
No.
Anyway.
we're universal. We're bands from outer space. You know, if you...
So on this Al-centric episode, Al brought up a question a few episodes ago. I'm not sure exactly when.
Oh, is this the one that you're going to... Okay, all right. That I don't know about?
Oh, this whole thing is just nothing but just...
Oh, okay, all right.
But Al had asked me if I read comics differently than I did as a kid.
Yes, I remember.
Now, I couldn't really answer it because I wasn't sure. To me, the comics I get, I guess one comic store owner made a comment that I was pretty eclectic. Well, I mean, I read all kinds of comics. It depends on, I guess, who the creator is and just how, you know, what the piece is. But most of the time when I get the comics, I can't wait to get them home and read them just the same. I do look at how things are put together. You know, I always look at the design thing, but I think I always have. But I've just been reading a book that Al told me about, Marvel Comics, The Untold Story by Sean Howe. And, you know, I wanted to be a cartoonist. I was never able to get that far.
Not yet, anyway.
Well, thanks for that. But
not until our comic book comes out.
But I've never stopped enjoying drawing and, you know, making my own stuff. It was just fun. But reading this, I just thought, man, I'm glad I never did for Marvel Comics.
Uh-oh, we got a story here.
Well, it's just, I guess it'd be like any job you have, you know. If you get too down into it and see all the things going on, it just takes the fun out of everything. It's like Wizard of Oz looking at the man behind the curtain.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking in your question, you're starting to see the nuts and bolts and how it's put together. I see that some, but I still read the comic book. And the story is just a normal, you know, much like I did when I was 12.
Yeah, I do too, but I get to looking at the technical aspect of it more now. It's just different for me, you know. It's kind of like you become more kind of like, not the word isn't jaded, more like, I don't know. It's just like I don't see the world the same as I did when I was a kid. I don't see movies the same. I don't see anything the same. I mean, yeah, deep down inside, you've got that little fascination for everything, but I view it in a completely different way, whether it's good or bad, I don't know, but, you know, that's just my thing.
You can't help but do that when you start having more life experience and, you know,
yeah,
moving on. But I do know you still have the wonder of things. You're very diverse. You appreciate all, even if you like the horror and the short stories. You have a wide, diverse appeal to everything. And even when I come to your house, it's just a lot of everything.
Like a bunch of crap all over the place.
No,
yeah, that's right.
It's treasure. It's wonderful treasure.
Yeah, some of it is treasure. Yeah, you know. I guess, you know, the older, you know, the more, like you said, the more you live, the more you get influenced by things. And you keep moving on and on and on. And then, you know, and I think these podcasts are good because this is a way for us to, you know, like we've absorbed all these things. And now we just kind of like let them out and tell people, you know, all you wonderful people out there in listener land, you know, what we think about stuff and what we know. And hopefully we influence you or make you laugh or cry or turn off the podcast or, you know, whatever. You know, you get a reaction. But, yeah, that's what's the good thing. And the thing, you know, my thing, too, is like turning people on to cool artists that they might not have heard about or seen from the past or whatever. So that's like my favorite thing to do.
Yeah, that's the one too. I really enjoy that. And sometimes it brings up things that I haven't read in a while, you know, and I've learned a lot from you.
I've learned a lot from all of you guys.
Well, I've learned I'm a big Jesse Marsh fan.
I'm glad you are, because he's awesome. He really is awesome.
Well, a lot of the Golden Age artists, they weren't signed. You know, there's a few.
Yeah.
But I still remember, what was it, first Wildcat story. Yeah, it was in one of the old DC reprints from the Action Comics or Detective. But Irwin Hasen did it, which...
That's right.
In Oklahoma, you know, there's at a newspaper strip called Dondi. It was in Texas.
There's actually a movie of Dondi, believe it or not. Not that great, but there is a movie.
I have trouble believing that.
There is. I saw it. Not too good.
But Irwin Hasen did a lot of a Golden Age comic work.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
But those guys were rare. I think Bob Montana signed his name.
Bob Montana signed his name. I've seen some stuff like Golden Age where Infantino signed his name. I posted one on the blog the other day. Kubert, I don't know if he did or not. Those guys were like teenagers when they did that. They probably weren't even that proud of their work, some of them anyway. You know, so.
Well, and that wasn't something that was encouraged. I don't think they were forbidden to do it, but I don't think it was encouraged. And like I said, some of these guys did sign it. And that is a criticism of Stan Lee, was he did put his name on everything. And, you know, of course, at the same time, he did put it out and have, you know, gave credit to all the creators, which was cool. And I think he was the one that started that.
Well, you know what? The the ACG comics had creator you know, credits in the 50s or early 60s.
Oh, okay.
They're actually doing that. DC, not till later. EC didn't, did they? No, not, I don't
I,
think
I
they
couldn't
did.
Tell you. I just always, whenever I read
Atlas
it.
Didn't either.
Yeah.
But I think ACG, American Comics Group, did
okay.
do it for a while.
Because I just, whenever I hear it, it's always attributed to Stan Lee. So I just figure, but I guess that's what people remember.
He popularized it. Nowadays, you know, it's like, sometimes I don't even want to know who drew it. You know, I'm kind of like, you know, oh, okay, well, that's cool. You know, I mean, I'll find out. You know, everybody, almost all the artists have blogs and you can find them out. But you know, it's something that was really weird. I mean, this is going off on a different tangent. I was noticing that some companies were really big into splash page, but some of them weren't. And they would have like either like the first page would be like, you know, big wide panel and then two underneath, like EC did that or whatever. And then I started reading and saying that for a while there, Jim Shooter was, or somebody from Marvel was the guy who decided that on the splash page of the comic book, you don't have to have the first page showing the superhero using their superpower or whatever. Have you read anything about that, or you know what
yeah,
I'm talking about?
Yeah. On the book, I can't put the book down.
It's a great book from what I hear.
Yeah, well, when I finish it, if you don't mind, I'd
like
you to read
it. Yeah, I want
to
read it. Yeah, my friend in Miami has read it twice already.
Well, it's just amazing. Like I said, these things I've seen, you know, I mean, I lived through a lot of it, but I just always saw it from afar. And it's kind of weird to read it in context and finding out some of the things that what caused it. So, I mean, when I'm trying to tell somebody, I'm just going to butcher the book, so I'm not really going to bother. But there is a whole thing about Jim Shooter and how he ended up taking over Marvel, or running Marvel. And then he had his own ideas about just exactly what you talked about, establishing shots.
Yeah.
And he wanted a change to happen, you know, within the first three pages. Like you show the guy in, you know, the hero in regular clothes, and then something happens. And he didn't like different angles. He wanted you to like the camera pointing straight at you. Like everything was, I can't remember how they
like a medium it. Shot or something?
Yeah, medium shots all the time.
I see. Yeah, he didn't want the forced perspectives or the,
right.
you know, the low angles or anything.
Which
like
explains
that.
Why Gene Colan was always in the outs and ended up leaving and going to D.C. Because he was the antichrist of Jim Shooter, I guess.
Yeah, he was all over the place.
Yeah, well, that's what made him who he was.
That's why he liked Jim Mooney and all those guys so much, because they were like straight-on artists or whatever.
You know, I've said this at times. I like the clear line style. I like bright, fun things. But even though that's what I prefer and what I like, that's not all I want. And, you know, I like Watchmen. I like Dark, you know, Dark Knight Returns. I love those. But I don't want everything to be just like them all the time either.
No, you want diversity.
Yeah, and basically, if, you know, you can't like everything. But that's what Shooter was trying to do. What surprised me about him was they were having to redo comics. He wouldn't accept them. Like,
are you serious? Yeah.
Yeah.
I did read that. I was looking up on him a little bit today.
But it was rampant. And
he made Gene Colan redo stuff, didn't he?
He made them all. He made Mike Zeck redo things. But, I mean, they'd have the finished pencils, and he says, this isn't right. And he'd make them redraw the whole issue. You know, or
the whole issue.
Sometimes he make them rewrite.
Oh, you mean like on Secret Wars or something
well,
like that, right?
Well, he did that
right?
to Mike Zack on Secret Wars. I think Mike Zack ended up leaving, and somebody else did a fill-in. And then when Secret Wars 2 came on, it got even worse. And Sal Buscema quit. I don't know if he was
really.
I think he was working on Secret Wars.
Huh.
I didn't know any of these things, but as it went on, Shooter just got worse and worse.
Well, I mean. There's something to be said about somebody that has like a vision of what he wants, but you just can't be like a totalitarian, you know, and impose your vision on everybody, because every artist is different. Every human being is different.
Yeah, I agree. And they didn't explain really why. I mean, you know, they talked about, you know, what was going on and what was happening, and then slowly he started doing that.
But what's funny was, as you were talking about that whole, you know, idea of like this and that and the other thing. But I think he left Frank Miller alone, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Michael Kaluta said something when I saw him in Tampa. Well, this was after Jim Shooter, I guess it was 88. And Jim Shooter was gone from Marvel, which surprised me. I didn't think he'd ever be gone. And some people were talking, and Michael Kaluta said, well, people only talk about the bad things. He says there were things Jim Shooter did. He said at the very beginning when Frank Miller was starting out, Jim Shooter would show up at his house with a couple of bags of groceries.
Oh, wow.
Jim Shooter would, advance pay, do things to help him pay rent and stuff out of his own pocket. This is in the book. This is Michael Kaluta saying that. He said he did a lot of things like that just because he had interest and he's trying to help somebody out. And that's something. How many people would actually do that? And he said, so if you want to remember all the things people didn't like he did, that's fine. But remember some of the good things he did as well.
Well, I have a Jim Shooter story.
Well, go ahead.
I think it was in 82. There was a convention up in West Palm, and I went with my friend. And he was going to be there. I think Tom DeFalco was there, a couple of editors maybe. And, we just brought our art up there to, have him take a look at it and see what he thought. So, I brought my art in front of him. Ralph Cabrera was there. And Jim Shooter was really nice to me. He was really complimentary, liked my work. And he actually offered me a tryout job, a paid tryout job. It was like a vision story that, like a five-page, it was a pain in the ass to draw. And it didn't really, lead to any more work for Marvel. But he was very nice, and I he got Ralph a job too. Ralph ended up working with Marvel. And I don't have anything bad to say about the guy. Right. But I hear so many stories that are so negative about him that maybe it was like it's one of those things where it was like I can say that he was very nice to me, but I've heard so many other things, it kind of makes you wonder,
Well, I've always heard that. I remember when he took over Marvel, there was a lot of things going on in Marvel I really liked in the early 80s, when you're talking about.
Yeah.
And, even though I know it was Archie Goodwin that launched the whole Epic thing.
Yeah.
But it was Wall Shooter was editor-in-chief of Marvel. And, the Frank Miller stuff was coming out. I mean, there's a lot of things at Marvel.
Sienkiewicz was going crazy around that time.
Absolutely.
He let him be. I think I heard that he had his, there was some artists that he felt maybe were more artistic, and he would leave them to their own or younger guys. And then maybe some of the older guys he was trying to, I don't know how to explain it. But he definitely had a liking for Frank Miller, for Bill Sienkiewicz, no doubt about it.
Yeah, well, and John Byrne was another one.
And John Byrne,
he always left John Byrne alone, but at one point, he didn't. And their relationship, according to the book, was starting to come apart. I remember when it happened. It's Jean Grey, when she came back. Because she came back in the Fantastic Four, and Butch Geist, he was the one that drew those two pages. Mm. But that's in the book, and that's what's strange is, something was going on, and Chris Claremont was upset about what was going on in some of the other books, because he was doing X-Men and New Mutants, and I think there were Butch Geist and Bob Layton were going to do X-Factor.
Okay.
And originally what they were going to do was they had to bring a girl.
Do X-Factor.
Yeah, they did, yeah. But they were planning on doing X-Factor, but the problem they were having was they had to bring a girl into it, because, Jean Grey was dead. And Chris Claremont had plans for Cyclops to marry Madeline Pryor and basically just go off in the sunset and retire. That was always his plan. He said that, Scott always had such a bad life, and, after all the Jean stuff, he just kind of kept him in the background so nobody else would use him. Well, then all of a sudden the whole X-Factor thing came about. He had no control. He was upset, and they were going to bring Scott back into it. And I'm kind of butchering this. They were trying to figure out how to bring a girl into the strip. And somehow it turned out, and I think Chris Claremont demanded that he be able to write that. John Byrne had already put the book together showing Jean Grey coming back. And Chris Claremont said it needs to be this way. So Shooter agreed to let Chris Claremont rewrite those two pages.
Mm.
And I think John Byrne didn't know about it, and they just got Jackson Geese to draw it like John Byrne would, which in the book they said he did a pretty good job, but I remember reading that, and I thought, well, somebody else did this. And which that would be, I'd be upset if I was the writer and artist of one book and they did that. And Chris Claremont was upset about something else that happened in the past because of John Byrne. So it just went from one side and up the other. And that's basically John Byrne was going over to do Superman. I guess he's going to work for both Marvel and DC. And then I've heard different stories. Pat was saying that Shooter said you can't do Fantastic Four and Superman. You're gone. But I think John Byrne, according to the book, he just got fed up and finally left.
I believe
But,
it. I mean, the
yeah.
ego, you know, I mean, two big
Well,
egos
yeah.
colliding against each other.
But that's the thing, Jim Shooter would start, he would be fine with some people and just step in and start, stepping on toes for no reason. But there was a lot of rewrites and a lot of redrawing of whole issues.
Damn,
I
that's not
mean, and
good.
there was a couple of times where it was like three times for one issue. And Tom DeFalco was freaking out because, they were losing money. It was destroying deadlines,
That reminds me that I seem to remember a story, now that you said that, where maybe even Jackson, my Butch guys, had to redraw a book.
Yeah.
I think he had to redraw a book. It might have been one of the X Factor books or whatever, because when Shooter saw it, he thought it was, he didn't like it, so he wanted him to simplify it and make it
Yeah.
easier to.
He was doing that all the time, according to this. And I mean, like I said, Mike Zack, I think, was about to have a breakdown.
Yeah,
And,
especially if you're on a deadline or something.
well, that was the other thing that, other, like Dom DeFalco was getting upset about, was you had a printer fine. If you missed a deadline, you paid fines to the print house.
Great.
And then also, the distributors. There was fines all the way around. So it's not like a missed deadline. They were talking in this book. Right now I'm reading, I read up to the Image, when Image Comics started, which it's still, even reading it, it's kind of hard to quite understand how all that happened. But,
Well, I think they were. I think they wanted out anyway. They gave them an offer that they
oh
could
yeah, they
refuse.
did, and they kept looking at Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby and what happened to them, which, a lot of
Yeah,
people were. But no,
understandable.
it's just amazing. Todd McFarlane was, I think he played baseball.
He was a minor league baseball
Yeah, and he
player.
was trying out for he was trying out for some team in California, I think.
Okay.
And a pro team, a major league team. And then he was I can't remember what he saw some. He went to a convention, I guess, a San Diego Comic Con. And he was shocked when he saw it, and all of a sudden he just started drawing. And I don't know if he drew before. He must have, But after that, he just started drawing as much as he can. He decided he wanted to work at Marvel.
Oh.
And then I guess he blew his knee out or something. He
Oh,
couldn't play anymore. And so he just went on to Marvel. But I mean, that's kind of staggering if he did that and had that kind of success that fast.
yeah, I think he started out at DC first, though, because I seem to
Yeah.
remember
Well, he replaced, the first time I saw him was Alan Davis was with Mike W. Barr was doing, I think it was Detective Comics. It was Batman Year
Yeah, those
Two.
Detective Year Ones or Year Two or
Yeah,
whatever.
because Frank Miller and
Year
David
Two.
Mazzucchelli did Year One in
Yeah,
Batman.
Alan Davis had a problem. He quit after the first issue, I
I think
think.
he did two issues and then quit. And then
Yeah.
they got McFarlane. I have to say, I really liked the Todd McFarlane cover. Batman was holding the gun, and it was really neat looking. I was disappointed with the insides, but again, it was a stark change from Alan Davis. And I think Alfredo Alcala drew the
Yep.
fourth one. But so I don't know McFarlane what else he was doing there. But then the next thing you know, he was doing Spider-Man. And
And that was during the shooter year? Yeah, it was during the shooter year, towards the end of the shooter year.
And I read an interview Todd McFarlane told, or I don't know if it was Todd McFarlane or it was Jim Salicrup who wrote it. One of them said that they're going to make Spider-Man the number one book, and the other one just laughed, yeah, right, and they did. Spider-Man overtook X-Men
Wow.
and became the biggest, and for a while they were doing it bi-monthly, or
Yeah, that's
bi-weekly, I'm
right.
sorry, twice
That's
a
right.
month.
Yeah, remember, God. 87, 88, around there. Yeah. And when Spider-Man got married and all that stuff, that was like the 300th issue, I think, or
Yeah.
something. God, it's now it's up to 700. It's scary.
This guy I trained with is I was surprised to find out he drew. I knew him all this time, I didn't know you drew. Kind of found that his mom worked at a comic shop. She worked at Wonder Water, where Dallas worked.
Really? Wow.
And, later on, I laughed about that. And so she'd always bring home comic books. He'd look through them. And then at one point, I just told him, I just can't even imagine. He says, that sounds to me like the coolest mom in the world, to work at a comic store and bring comics home. And then he just looked distant and said, well, her heart was in the right place. This is when all the speculator stuff was going on. So
that's
when
I was working there.
Yeah, so she got a job, and she was bringing all these comics home that were supposed to pay for his college education when he got older.
Oh, that one, okay.
So she was bringing Todd McFarlane, Spider-Man, certain things like
those
that.
Those have value.
And when he was talking about it, there were several of us at his house, and I said, I read a couple of those issues. There were some neat, interesting things they were doing. Says, I guess what surprised me, and I've always said this, the characters, it didn't matter, Superman, Lois Lane's always chasing Superman. Of course, I think in the 90s they got married, but, it's always, I don't know, to me, namby-pamby. It's something that started back in the 40s, and it just continues to go on and on, and it never seems to change. So I thought that was kind of interesting that Peter Parker married Mary Jane. And Mary Jane was supposed to be a model. And then I guess when Todd McFarlane drew it, she did look like a supermodel. And I bought two issues. And I remember one of them was Peter Parker saw the Adventure Comics where Superman introduced Supergirl to the world. And they redrew the cover in the Spider-Man comic.
I remember that book, yeah.
And I thought that was interesting. And I think they went to a comic store or a convention or something. And Peter Parker saw that. So that's the first comic I ever bought right there. And he's looking at it. And later when they got home, he found out Mary Jane bought it. And he said, well, that's a lot of money. Well, she was a high fashion model. She made a lot of money. But, just little things like that I thought was interesting. And then, we were slow at work. I bought a stack of comics and brought them in, and I bought those two Spider-Man issues. And a friend of mine went through reading my comics, and he showed those. These are dumb. I didn't think they were dumb. They were just superhero comics. But I was reading later that Jim Salicrup was talking about plans that I guess all of Peter Parker's Spider-Man shots somebody took and put into a coffee table book. And so he was going around the nation with Mary Jane promoting the book. And he said that was a thing that's starting to be a windfall for Peter because this is work he'd already done and been paid for. And now he's got this coffee table book coming in, so it's extra money. And also Mary Jane, was a high fashion model that made, a good sum of money. So he said the whole change is, my whole life, Peter Parker was stone broke. There was times where he was homeless. He didn't have a place to stay and had to find somebody to live with. He was always trying to figure out how to scrape together money for rent or just to buy food or film, And he said, so that's the change in Peter's life was understanding, what to do. Money wasn't an issue. Well, I don't know. That's life. That's kind of interesting. I've never read the books. But they were doing a lot of things. I know John Byrne wanted to do Spider-Man. Michael Golden wanted to do Spider-Man. There was a couple of other people. I think Frank Miller wanted to do Spider-Man. But they all wanted to make him skinny like Steve Ditko used to draw instead of the John Romita muscle man. And Marvel would say no, and they'd always put him on some other book.
Mm.
And then I was always surprised that Todd McFarlane came in and did exactly that, which I thought was neat. A friend of mine had made a comment, says, well, yeah, it is neat, but I would have preferred they would have let one of those other guys do that as well. But that's why I picked it up. I just thought it was neat. He was skinny and all twisty, more twisty than Steve Ditko ever did. But
yeah, definitely. But I still don't understand. I guess it must be like one of those right place, right time, right moment thing. I still don't understand why people to this day really like McFarlane's work that much. To me, it's just like, I don't find it particularly well drawn, and that's the first part. So you've got a lot of detail and a lot of line work. I guess he's got so much detail in it and so many little like things that kids or younger people maybe get into all that and just don't see that it's kind of like awkward looking or whatever. I never understood. And I never understood why he was so popular. But then again, Somebody could say the same thing about Jack Kirby, you know, back in the old days, you know. But Jack Kirby's work had a power. I guess maybe McFarlane's work had some kind of power, you know, that the kids liked.
I think it did. I always look at those Image guys as Art Adams wannabes, you know.
Yes, agreed.
I mean, I liked Art Adams, but he always had a lot of detail in it and stiff, skinny figures. And to me, those guys reminded me of that. Something they brought up in the book I never thought about. I never read these guys. You couldn't help but see them. You know, they were all around you. But they said that they weren't doing the work that they always done before, like establishing shots, you know, like a television show or a film, where you had your establishing shot and then the final finishing shot. He said what they were doing, it was more like a MTV video, where it was just kind of a lot of images coming here and there. Todd McFarlane was in a couple of interviews bragging about, you could take any, when he was doing Spider-Man, you could take all the pages he drew for one issue, toss them up in the air, and put them together in any order you want. And I think he did Spawn that way as well. I've never read those.
For storytelling.
Well, I don't know. Maybe there's a beauty to that, you know, again, they were treating it like an MTV video. I know Liefeld did that, they say in the book, and so did McFarlane, I guess a couple of others.
What they were doing was just trying to create like artistic montages or whatever that could be interpreted any way you wanted to or whatever. Not necessarily carrying on a linear story or anything like that. Just kind of like following an idea, and just whoever the writer is would just caption it, so make it flow, I guess.
Well, Liefeld was another one. He was 21 when he started working for Marvel.
Wow, that young.
And but, you know, I remember when he did that Levi's commercial. I didn't know who he was. You know, I was kind of, all the stores here in town dried up, so I'd only get them when I go somewhere else on vacation. So I was kind of out of it, and I thought, well, you know, and I hadn't read X-Men or anything. But he was doing a Levi's commercial, said he was, I guess, drawing one of the Axe titles. And I could, man, have I been out that long? Well, come to find out, no, he just got big that quick. But, he jumped in and he was doing stuff, and at one point he was complaining about Chris Claremont, and Chris Claremont was basically taken off the books.
Wow.
You know, that's when Jim Lee and Liefeld was doing all the X-Books, and it's a couple of other people. I think Will
Portacio. Yeah. He was the anchor and drawing artist, yeah.
And, but I just found that it was just weird how all of a sudden it happened, and these guys basically came in and took over.
And all these guys came in during the Shooter years. McFarlane might have. The other ones might not have.
I'm not sure if it's Shooter or DeFalco. But it was Bob Harris is the one that basically let them take over completely.
Okay.
And according to the book, reading, I said, how did this happen? Well, Bob Harris was doing it.
Okay.
And when Chris Claremont left, one thing they found he was having trouble was to be an independent, you know, have an independent comic, you have to be an artist. You know, because the artist could make, trading cards and T-shirts and stuff and sell them. But it's the only thing he could do is put a script on a T-shirt, you know. And, they say that in the book, and maybe it was the time, but explain to me Robert Kirkman, you know, and some of these guys. They're writers. They have their own, well, I think Robert Kirkman drew, too, in the beginning.
Did he really? I didn't know that.
I don't know if it's him or it's one of those writers that are really big.
I'll explain Robert Kirkman in a few words to you. Pure luck. That's two words. Pure luck.
You really think so?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not putting down his writing.
Yeah.
I'm not putting down his storytelling. But how many zombie books did you see before? Like Dead World and other ones that didn't do squat. And all of a sudden this thing takes off. Like, you know, out of the blue. I mean, he's a good writer, but I mean, and the artist Tony Moore was okay, but he wasn't like, oh my God, this is the greatest art I've ever seen. And Charles Adler's not, oh my God, this is the greatest art I've ever seen, you know, but it became some kind of phenomenon. I think it was because of the fact that he wasn't afraid to like kill people or just make it more brutal than it had been done before. But I've seen books come out that are just as brutal and just as, like, well-written or whatever, and they don't do Jack. Again, I think he's a McFarlane. He just came in at the right time with the right book. It caught on, And that's what it's all about. You know, you can be the most talented guy in the world, but if you don't hit the mark at the right time, it's going to be like, you'll be good. You'll have a career.
I think there's an art to that too, but I don't, you know, one thing I will say, Todd McFarlane, he wasn't like a passive person where he came in and was just lucky. I mean, he, you know, in the book, he jumped in and, you know, did this, did that. And
yeah, but when we were talking about people, Todd McFarlane was I think, influenced by, we were talking about him before, not Michael Golden, but what's his name? Heavily influenced, Art Adams.
Yeah.
Heavily influenced by Art Adams. Why didn't Art Adams become, like, the greatest artist of all time?
Art Adams would have been. He was too slow. All the detail he was putting in just took forever. Because that was the thing they were talking about when Art Adams started. You know, they never mentioned Mike Mignola in this book either. Because Mike Mignola started out with Art Adams.
Yeah, but he didn't hit until later on.
Yeah, but
Cosmic Odyssey was around that time or whatever.
I love that book.
That's when
I really started liking him a lot.
Yeah, but his art evolved a lot after that, and then it became the Hellboy and all that stuff or whatever.
But they were talking about Art Adams and how he stepped in and started doing things, and I think they wanted to do more, but, you know, he couldn't do that much work. So he basically became a star artist just by jumping in on a book here and there. But, yeah, all the image guys, I think, were huge Art Adams influence.
Oh, God, yeah. Especially McFarlane, all the detail and the spindly characters and all that stuff. Except Art Adams had a bit stronger basis, you know, had a stronger art sense than McFarlane, Liefeld, and things. Jim Lee is a good artist. He's a good structural artist. Even Silvestri is a good structural artist. But McFarlane's stuff is just squirrely and just like, you know, I guess it hits a chord with people that, like, maybe it was like, again, at the right time, you saw it as a kid and it was like, oh, my God, this is so much better than, whoever else was drawing comics at the time. You know, Don Perlin, who I love, or Jim Mooney, whose work I love, or whoever, you know. It was just like, wow, this is so different. This is so cool, you know. But it really is Art Adams on some maybe steroids, a little bit more a little bit more Adderall or whatever. I don't know.
Well, you know, that's the thing. You know, Todd McFarlane, he was a lot behind the image when they moved. You know, Liefeld was doing stuff.
Yeah.
And then McFarlane, the two of them, basically got the other guys to convince them. Jim Lee was basically a company man for Marvel. He was doing well. He liked being on the X-Men. And when they were talking to him, he wasn't really going for it. But the thing was, I guess they were doing some big auctioning off all this artwork, original art. And I guess Jim Lee was being showcased for something, to give an award or whatever. And then Marvel came and told Jim Lee that the accommodations of flight wouldn't be paid for his wife. You know, it was just him. And that's what kind of set Jim Lee off. And when they went to the auction, I guess they sold one of his page. I think they sold a Spider-Man page for $39,000, one of Jim Lee's pages.
Wow.
And then they sold one of Todd McFarlane's Spider-Man pages for $41,000. And then Jim Lee came over, talked to McFarlane and Liefeld, says, "I'm with you guys." And I said, what he started doing, I said, Jim Lee was a smart guy. He started thinking the last 3 months he made Marvel, $7 million or something like that. And they wouldn't pay $200 for his wife's plane fare.
Yeah.
And he said he was just, you know. Of course, at the same time, these guys are making far more money than any cartoonist that ever worked for.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah. That was the times, man.
But they
John Byrne made more money than a lot. Made similar money to those guys with the Superman books. And
well, John Byrne was talking about, you know, I guess he wasn't bitter about it. He just said that. And he didn't make anywhere near. He says his prime was before the royalties came out. You know, the X-Men, of course. Well, he did Superman. I think he got royalties. But he was just talking about he didn't. He just got the rates. He made Marvel a lot of money. And then when he was no longer a fan favorite, you know, that was that.
I'll tell you what. All the guys that did the Death of Superman made buku dinero. Because I know Geist made a lot of money off that. I mean, he made enough money to buy himself like a farm or at least a big house with a lot of property on it. They made they made mucho dinero on the death of Superman. So they were paying good royalties in 1991 or whatever it was, or 92 or whatever it was when it came out.
Well, John Byrne was talking about it in the book. They did bring up when he was creating...
Well, John Byrne bought the Singer Mansion in Connecticut. He must have made millions off that
Superman.
Well,
somebody told me this is in 84, 83, 84. My friend Britt and met a couple of guys that are doing Iron Man for Marvel at the time, and they said John Byrne's getting close to making his first million.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was making money, so I don't know. But according to the book, he said that the royalty program wasn't in effect when he was hitting it, when he was doing everything.
Okay. He must have been making a lot of reprints, maybe?
Well, Superman, I know he had a royalty percentage, because I know Jerry Ordway was working on Adventures of Superman, I think it was.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
It was a book. That was my favorite of the Superman titles at the time. The stories were good. I liked his artwork.
Yeah, that was a good one, yeah.
But, you know, it was a monthly book, and he was really having trouble keeping up with it. And one thing he was saying, I guess he did eventually, I think Eric Larson filled in one issue, did a quite good job.
He was another guy that went to Image,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Because he took over Spider-Man after McFarlane,
right.
I think.
There was a reason he left, too. But
he was one of the hot shots.
Yeah,
he took Spider-Man over, and it still sold well.
Yeah. But there was something that happened to him, too. And, of course, they kept looking at what happened to Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko.
And Jim Valentino was another one that went
to
Image, too.
But, anyway, they, I'm losing my train of thought.
I mean, the whole thing about what happened to Kirby and Ditko, I can understand where they're coming from and saying, like, well, you know, they made all the money and blah, blah, blah. But like we said before, John Byrne made millions off mainstream comic books. So as far as I'm concerned, these guys probably, my opinion, they were big stars. They saw their artwork going for a lot of money. They said, hey, you know, let's go for it all. You know, why share? Let's do it all. Let's own our own characters. Let's have movies made about and own the characters, which makes sense.
Well, I guess Stan Lee, for a while, they had him doing a show. They'd record it, and he'd interview artists.
Okay.
And he had McFarlane on it. McFarlane had on.
I think there were videotapes of that.
Yeah,
like
videotapes.
Stan Lee, yeah.
But they had Todd McFarlane had a character nobody knew. They never mentioned on the show, but it was Spawn. I guess he had a big drawing, a big poster Spawn in the background. And Rod Liefeld was on it. They had he had something, Destroyers or something, some strip. And I think he was going to take it to Marvel, and then, I don't know, whoever was in charge was saying, well, we can't use this. Or they were complaining about something. It's just, oh, it's fine, I'll take it elsewhere. And it turned into Youngblood.
Oh, the Image.
And he was, I guess, advertising Youngblood in a comics buyer's guide or something.
Okay.
But anyway, when he was on Stan Lee's show, he was drawing on the show, and he drew, you know, they said it was the Cable lookalike character that was in Youngblood.
Yeah, I don't know what his name is, but yeah.
But he said Stan Lee was, well, is this a character that you've done? No, he hasn't been published. So you're making up right here on the spot? Yeah. And Stanley said, well, you know, my lawyers will sit there and say that we're co-creating this right here. Because, you know, Stanley was there.
Oh, God.
And then Rob Liefeld looked up at him and says, have your lawyer contact my lawyer. And I thought, well, yeah, that's Stan Lee. If he's in the area, then he co-creates it. Anyway, I think he was.
Boy, he gave himself away there. Yeah.
But now
we can go with now. When you said that, now you reminded me of something that I wanted to talk to you about, because you know that book basically relates the storyline where basically Stan Lee at some point wasn't even coming up with the storylines. Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko were coming up with stories, and Stan Lee was just dialoguing them or whatever, with the notes written on the sidebars of the pages or whatever to give them an idea of what the story was. Now, you know, I mean, I agree, and I think Stan and Steve, I mean, Jack and Steve deserve more, 90% of the credit for the books or whatever, but would you see Marvel Comics being successful as it became without Stan Lee?
No. And I've always given Stan Lee credit for this. One thing, Marvel was doing 8 books, and Stan Lee was overseeing everything.
Yeah, he was.
Now, when I say that, I mean, he wasn't. I've heard different stories. I grew up under the impression that Stan Lee wrote every single thing.
That's the impression that he would give you.
Yeah, and that is credited as writing and editing every single thing. And then Jack Kirby in Comic Scene Magazine brought up that Stan Lee didn't write those, he wrote them. And he went on about he wrote the stories and Stan Lee added the dialogue. Well, that made sense to me because Stan Lee really didn't write too much after that, and he didn't create anything, you know. I always thought he created Nova. He did not. Marv Wolfman created Nova when he was in high school. And they brought the character in, but I think Stan Lee was maybe writing the character at the beginning. But he didn't create anything. And I guess he wrote for a couple of years, and then after that he was always just, and there was a couple of times where he was looking at applying to DC thinking he was going to be fired.
From Marvel?
Yeah, from Marvel.
Wow.
And then they, you know, like I said, he set himself up as the voice and face of Marvel Comics. So, you know, they kept him on, but a lot of times I took it that he was just getting money for, you know, past work of being the face of Marvel.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about how, like, Atlas Comics was Marvel in the 50s, and then, like, there came a day where, like, they had so much inventory that Martin Goodman fired everybody, and they just ran on inventory for a few years.
Oh, real quick, on the original thing, I saw Gil Kane in 1982 in Dallas, Texas, and Gil Kane explained how Marvel worked, and he said, you know, Stan Lee was overseeing the whole line. There was no way he had time to write the stories. He says, so what he would do was he would have an idea and talk to the cartoonist about it. And the cartoonist would take the, you know, the thing and basically write the story while they drew it. And then when they finished, Stan Lee would go in and dialogue all the word balloons. And so I thought, okay, I can see that. But basically, whoever the cartoonist was, that was the Marvel way, was actually writing the story. But there was times, I do know in the Spider-Man, Steve Ditko and Stan Lee, well, it was mostly Steve Ditko, wouldn't speak to Stan Lee. He got fed up with what Stan Lee was doing. So Stan Lee had nothing to do with Spider-Man until the pages, you know, Steve Ditko finished came in, and then he dialogued them. So Steve Ditko was completely directing and writing Spider-Man from a certain point.
But now when Steve Ditko left, Stan was writing those issues.
Yeah, with John Romita.
Yeah, so he was doing that at least.
Yeah, he took that one back over.
And it became a more popular book in a lot of ways after that.
Yeah, the sales went up with John Romita.
Yeah, they went up, and it became like, I mean, the FF was Jack Kirby's baby, but Spider-Man ended up becoming like Stan Lee's kind of, like, you know, he took it to the higher, you know, he took it to success, more success than he was.
Well, when Jack Kirby left, I've read this on the internet. They said that John Romita asked Stan Lee, says, who's going to draw FF? And Stan Lee didn't even look up. He says, you are. And John Romita, you know, he thought that was kind of odd because Spider-Man was the number one book. Fantastic Four was the second book by this time. But he didn't argue. He just did 2 issues, and then John Buscema took over. And, you know, like I said, John Romita said in an interview that the sales did go up. But he said, well, I don't think it was because of that. I think people just wanted to see what it looked like without Jack Kirby drawing it.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, like I said, I always liked John Romita. I liked him as an artist, and I always thought he was, you know, straight shooter. But in the book, they said that when that happened, Stan Lee was staggered when he found out Jack Kirby was gone. And all of Marvel Comics was shaking, thinking that was it. You know, that was the end of it. And then John Romita asked him, well, are you going to, is that it? Are you canceling Fantastic Four? And then Stan Lee says, no, you're drawing it. You know, so, but, you know.
There's one thing I don't like about John Romita.
What's that?
He had a, and I guess it was because he was the art director. Man, I see some books where all of a sudden he just, like, you're seeing a Gene Colan book, and he decides he's going to redraw a face of a character or whatever, and it just sticks out like a sore thumb. He did it to a lot of books. I can't think of one right now at the top of my head, but I will try to find someone where it was almost like he redrew every face on the book. It was kind of like what they did to Kirby when he went to DC, where they got, I think it was Al Plastino and or Murphy Anderson to do Superman's face or Jimmy Olsen's face or whatever. Right. It was annoying.
Well, you know, we talked about the Superman versus Spider-Man, the Ross Andrews drew and Dick Giordano and Neil Adams. And this, you know, I've read it a few times.
Yeah, he redrew the Superman faces. Yeah.
Well, and I never read this until recently, but I've heard it that John Romita did the same thing with the Spider-Man cast. He drew the faces for Peter Parker. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I believe it. Well, you know, to me, some of that could be a real disaster, but that book just came out magic. Everybody was on model. You know, everything to me on that book was the way it should have been. It was just a great comic book. And it certainly deserved the oversized format that it was in.
Yep.
And even though Neil Adams and John Romita, you know, did things on it, it still stayed cohesive. It didn't look piecemeal. It looked like it should have. So
I remember DC covers that were drawn by Neil Adams, and they would do that thing. They would get Plastino or somebody to draw the Superman face. Everything else would be Neil Adams. All of a sudden, you see like the generic old Superman face, and I'm like, why? Why would you do this? I mean, would it really freak out the viewer, you know, or the kids? Well, that's not Superman. That's like some other dude or whatever. I never understood that mentality. But then again, back then they were actually making comics for kids. Now it's like they're making comics for, I don't know what.
50-year-olds.
Yeah, and or alternative younger people or whatever. I don't try to figure it out or, you know, think about it too much.
Well, on that note, let's have a music break. We're going to play my favorite artist, Hitomi.
Well, all right.
Don't
And that was Hitomi. If you want to see her, go to Japan. Anyway.
Yeah, there you go.
She's my favorite.
She, you know, go to YouTube. I'm sure you'll find something.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of YouTube. One word of warning, I found Japan must have a lot of Hitomis, because there's Hitomi Yaida, Hitomi Shimada, and some of them are pornography, and be careful.
On YouTube?
Well, not on YouTube, but if you type in Google.
What's her last name, Hitomi?
Furuya or something, but she just goes, she's, her name is all undercase, and she just goes by Hitomi. So she could play soccer in Europe if she wanted, because she's a one-name person.
Cool.
Like Cher.
And, yeah, and Liberace, and all those guys.
Liberace.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, we were talking, one of your other questions was about Atlas Comics. You know, that's when they had a whole group of people working. Stan Lee was there working
Jack
for
Jack and Steve and, you know.
I don't think they were working there at the time. I think they were already gone. Huh. Well, Jack Kirby left with Joe Simon. They were doing their own stuff.
For Harvey or whatever.
And, well, they were packaging comics for other publishers.
What years are we talking about?
This was in the 50s.
What? 50 what? 50,
I don't know.
55, 56, 57?
One thing they were getting, Atlas Comics was getting a lot of, I couldn't tell you the actual year in it. When you read the book, you can...
Because Atlas, I mean, I have downloads of Atlas books, and all those ones that are like, I was Sprague, giant monster from like, you know, wherever. Those are from 57.
Yeah,
I think.
Those came later. I think it was earlier because they kept buying inventory stories and throwing them in. They had a closet, and it just kept happening. And at one point, Martin Goodman realized they had this closet full of inventory stories, and he had a coronary. And he said, why are we paying these people all this money if we have all this stuff? So he made, you know, Stan Lee fire everybody. So the whole society was gone. I think it was just Stan and, you know, his secretary.
Not Flo Steinberg.
I don't think it was her.
She didn't come till later.
It was just a couple of people. And they were just running inventory stories for years.
For years, huh?
And then later, Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko came in. They were doing, you know, monster stuff and all that. And I've heard different stories. Jack Kirby said in the Comics Journal, I guess it was in the 90s, that he basically talked about how after him and Joe Simon, you know, their company just basically went out from under them. Joe Simon just went to advertising, and Jack Kirby went to DC. And that's when he did Challenge of the Unknown and Green Arrow. He was drawing the Green Arrow.
Joe Simon did Sick Magazine, too, one of those mad...
Yeah, that came later.
...knockoffs. That might have been in the 60s, early 60s.
But he, but somebody, I think it was Al Plastino, somebody at DC did not like Jack Kirby.
Oh, really? Okay.
And then Jack Kirby was also doing the Sky Masters newspaper strip
with Wally Wood. And, that's like one of my all-time favorite artist anchor combination, Jack Kirby and Wally Wood. That's like an amazing. Yeah. Well, they did Challengers too.
Well, they were good friends. I didn't know that they stayed good friends all the way.
Oh, they did? Oh, okay. All right.
And I know that's when Jack Kirby went back to DC and was doing New Gods and Mr. Miracle and all that, Vince Coletta was inking some of those. And it was Mark Evanier and Wally Wood convinced Jack Kirby to tell them to get him off the book. Because, you know, Jack Kirby would never, even if he didn't like the inker, he looked at it, they had to support their family,
and that's it. Right.
But, yeah, Wally Wood was the one convincing him, you got to get rid of this guy, so.
And that Wally Wood did ink, like, an issue of Sandman over Kirby, didn't he, or something like that?
He could have, I didn't know.
I think he did something. I can't think right now, anyway.
But, anyway, when, basically, whoever was at DC did not like Kirby. I apologize, I can't remember who it is. But that's kind of a famous story.
Well, Fantino didn't like Kirby. Carmen Infantino, who just passed away a few days ago.
He was the one that brought him to DC.
And he didn't like him, though. I don't think he liked his artwork, but he knew it was like bringing in, like, you know, a rock star or something into your, you know.
It was like hiring Elvis Presley for your
for your recording studio or whatever, or for your show or whatever. But yeah, I don't think he liked his artwork.
But when Jack Kirby, he said in Comics Journal that he needed work. You know, he wasn't in DC anymore. So he went to Martin Goodman. And he said when he went there, they were moving furniture. They were taking office furniture out. And he said Stan Lee was sitting on a desk crying. And Jack Kirby said, "What's going on?" They said they were closing it. So he went in and talked to Martin Goodman and said, "Look, stop moving furniture. You know, stop. I'll come here. I'll do books that'll sell." And, you know, he said that's what happened. Well, in the book, they talk about it. I guess they were kind of up in arms. You know, they weren't sure what to do, but they said they weren't moving out. I think they even brought up the Comics Journal issue that Jack Kirby said those things. But Jack Kirby did go in, needed work, and he did tell them, "I'll do books that'll sell." And they hired him, and again, him and Steve Ditko were still doing those Monster magazines. And then the whole story was that Martin Goodman was playing golf with, I think, Jack Leibowitz at DC. And he was talking about what a success the Justice League was. And so they came up with the Fantastic Four.
And the rest is history.
What was strange is Fantastic Four, the first, I think, first three issues, they didn't have uniforms. They just wore civilian clothes. And it was almost like the Challenge of the Unknown with superpowers.
Was the Fantastic Four, was it 61 or 62?
61,
wow.
But, you know, it kept building from there. I do know in the Galactus trilogy, Stan Lee had an idea for Galactus. It was a puff of smoke, you know, something like that, some vague thing. And he was shocked when Jack Kirby drew Galactus the way he did. He wasn't expecting it. And then he kept asking, "What's this Silver Surfer here?" Because, you know, Jack Kirby just added that. So that's the case, and Stan Lee did have input on some of the stories, you know. I've heard somebody mention that when you try to argue about something like that and who did what, it's like when people get divorced, you're trying to decide who takes the sofa and who takes the VCR. You know, I mean, you know, it's...
Well, it's like all those songs that were credited to Lennon and McCartney. Now you can tell who wrote which, usually, but they both contributed
The Beatles,
to each other's songs.
Yeah, well, not all, just that, even Harrison and Ringo Starr added stuff to those songs.
Of course, you know, like a solo. I mean, you
right.
know, George Martin added a lot, too.
Absolutely.
Everybody had input, but some, but like the main, like I would put Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby as a primary songwriter, and then everybody else as the collaborator.
Well, I agree, but I guess the difference is John Lennon never said he wrote every song the Beatles ever did and took all the credit for it.
No, but they were credited to Lennon and McCartney until the very end. If you didn't know any better, you'd think they both wrote them, like I did when I was a kid.
Well, George Harrison got credits for his songs.
Yeah, he did, but he was separate. It was always Lennon and McCartney. Everybody else got separate credit or whatever. They decided at first that they were going to be a songwriting team. Obviously, you could tell by who sings lead.
Right.
Pretty much who wrote the song or whatever, but they
Except
decided.
Except for Love Me Do.
That's true. Except for Love Me Do. But yeah, you know, that was definitely like, you could tell, but it was a collaboration also. It's the same with Marvel, you know?
And Yesterday was only credited to Paul McCartney.
No, it was credited to both.
I think it was just credited to Paul McCartney.
No, I'll have to check on that, but I think it's Lennon McCartney.
All right.
I think that was a partnership, man. I don't think they ever.
I always thought so too, but I think Paul McCartney credited Yesterday just to him.
Okay, we'll look it up and
If I'm wrong, I guess I'm going to get an in your face.
No, you're not going to get an in your face. You're just going to get like, but if you're right,
but
I'm like, Don, you are a
face.
Genius. You are a genius. I did not know that.
No, I think I read that, but I may not be right.
Yeah, I thought they were.
So, like I said, I do think Stan Lee. They work together, because I love those stories that they did together more than the solo work. But again, what surprised me was how Stan Lee just kind of, he was part of Marvel all the time, but he was always on the sides. You know, they're talking about when Roy Thomas ended up taking over.
Roy the Boy.
You know, Roy the Boy. The thing I never realized is Roy Thomas never created any characters for Marvel.
Never did.
I was reading that, and that was the thing they were coming down on him because, you know, you're expected to create characters for the company. And Roy Thomas is saying that, again, he kept seeing what was happening. If you create it, they take it, and you're tossed out. Now, he did do the Vision in the Avengers.
Did he create? No, the Vision was an old character.
Well, see, that's what I mean. They said he took an old character, and he mentioned it to John Romita, John Buscema. And then they, I guess, kind of reworked it and turned him into an android and took the original Human Torch. He did stuff like that. Now, I heard Len Wein on Fanboy Radio talking about, when they asked about Wolverine, he says, well, I was Roy Thomas. And he said, Len Wein created the character, but Roy Thomas was talking about, they were talking about the X-Men were going to be international, and we need some international characters. So they said, we never had a Canadian character. So that's where he said, what about the name Wolverine? So Len Wein created a character after that name, Roy Thomas. Same thing with Brother Blood, Brother Voodoo.
Brother Voodoo.
Who I loved. But he said
those beautiful Gene Colan issues and Strange Tales.
Well, I think John Romita, didn't he draw the first one? Or
he drew
did
some,
the cover?
But I think the ones I remember were the Gene Colan ones, more so the Romita ones.
But he said, in 1974, there's nothing cooler than a guy called Brother Voodoo, you know. But I always liked that. Was he? I think he was Haitian.
Yeah. That's where Voodoo comes from,
But he said the same thing. He told Len Wein, you know, we should have somebody called Brother Voodoo. And Len Wein created a character around that.
Did Len Wein, not that he's an original character by any means or whatever, did Len Wein create Swamp Thing?
Yeah, him and Bernie Wrightson.
But they are credited as creating it, aren't they?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they're always. He was, Swamp Thing is... It was an 8-page story in House of Mystery, I think.
House of Mystery, yeah.
And it was just an 8-page story. And like you and I said in the past, there was always a lot of muck monsters in comic books.
Well, there was a heap and all that.
I guess he was probably the original one.
He was the original one, yeah.
But there was a bunch of them. And that was confusing as a kid because Mad Magazine used to, once a year, they'd have a super special. And they'd always have one of their old comic books, like a collection of their best.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, one of those EC books.
Yeah, and which I loved. I had a few of them. And the first time they had it, on the cover of the Mad Magazine, it had Alfred E. Newman with the crew cut. And then it showed the comic book. And I bought it just to get the comic book on the inside. And it had Melvin in the Jungle, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And it had a Heap story. I can't remember what they called him. It wasn't the Heap. But, they read as an EC comic. I think it had a janitor or something introducing
the
story.
Yeah, right.
And but they're telling the whole story of the Heap, and you know, I was, I think, 10 or 11, and it was really confusing to me because Swamp Thing wasn't that old, and I thought, well, how is this old comic making fun of Swamp Thing? Not realizing there was 50 billion of them.
Yeah, right.
You know, smug monsters in comics. But yeah, anyway, they did that, and it was just a throwaway character, and people kept writing in. So I didn't know that Bernie Wrightson was supposed to be the artist for The Shadow.
Yeah, and then he turned it down to do Swamp Thing. And
well,
Kaluta got
yeah, he
it.
Was going to do it, and I guess he drew some house ads for it.
Yeah, you sent me a copy of it.
Yeah, and then Swamp Thing came up, so Bernie Wrightson went to that. And
that
kind
of worked well for both of them.
I agree, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But, anyway, that's with Atlas Comics. They laid everybody off, and then later on, Jack Kirby came in, and they did the Marvel Age of Comics, and there was, basically, it was the first 3 years is where everything happened that they built Marvel Comics on.
And yeah.
When Jack Kirby left, that whole company was up in arms thinking that was the end of it. They, you know, I've heard this in the past, and reading the book, you can see just how nerve-wracking that was. And then they said that Vince Coletta would bring Xerox pages of Kirby's pencils or the Fourth World stuff. Look what he's doing. And they'd hang them up on the walls, and I'll just stare at them like, oh my God, what's happening here? And they were just staggered. Of course, the New World, Fourth World, I guess didn't do all that well.
Nah.
And then what bothers me is later on when I guess the same thing was happening. Jack Kirby wasn't happy at DC. And I don't think Carmine Infantino cared for him after, like you said. So Jack Kirby you know, went back to Marvel. And Stan Lee was happy to get him back. And basically they wrote a deal that, just like Jack Kirby had at DC, he'd be left alone. And I think Steve Englehart was writing Captain America.
Yeah, I guess. I don't even remember.
What was this attitude I'm seeing here?
Because the magic was over.
I agree.
When he came back, it was over. It was just so sad. Because it was like he was on top of the world. You know, like the Carpenter song. And then, like, he did the DC thing. And then ended it with, like, Commandy and all this stuff that he did, which was cool. And when he came back to Marvel, it was like, yeah, they were happy to take him back. But it was just...
You know, I
just, how could you lose it in that few amount of years? But yeah, definitely.
Well, OMAC is my favorite Jack Kirby DC work.
Yeah, that was a good one.
I love that. And they canceled after 8 issues. Now, he was doing Commandy for a long time. And that was a good book people liked. But there was other books he did at DC. Well, I never cared
Sandman,
for
Sandman, he did.
Yeah, the Sandman, that was a strange one. Because I really liked
it. Demon
that.
Was cool.
Well, the first issue of Sandman, Joe Simon did it too.
Yeah, that's right.
And then DC didn't like it, and they basically let Simon go. I guess he did Prez too.
Prez.
Yeah, I don't know. It was kind of bizarre what Joe Simon was coming up with, and of course it makes sense he go do Sick Magazine.
Yeah.
But the problem with Sandman was Joe Simon basically, I guess he was let go from DC after the first issue.
Yeah.
And Jack Kirby was obligated to keep it going. Somebody, maybe Michael Fleischer wrote those stories after that.
Yeah, that sounds right. Sounds right.
And they didn't seem anything like, you know, what, the whole flavor was different. I remember the kid's grandfather died and he ended up living with, distant relatives that were really mean. It's turning to Cinderella.
Yeah. You're bringing back memories. Books I haven't read in a million years. Yeah.
And then Jack Kirby wasn't putting as much effort as he did on that first issue.
And the Demon.
Yeah, the Demon I never cared for.
I liked it.
Did you? Well, a lot of people read it, but... No, when he went back to Marvel, I remember he took over Captain America. I read it. I loved it. Joe Sinnott inked him.
Sinnott.
And, he also did the Black Panther.
Yep.
And I always bought these issues. I mean, at the store. And I remember my family, one time we were eating a Taco Bell, and there was a convenience store right behind it. So I'd finish eating, and I'd run over and get some comic books and come back, and I'd read them while I was waiting for everybody. My parents are pretty tolerant people. And I, thinking back on it. But I remember reading the Black Panther, and... Just telling you then, I thought, well, it wasn't anything I was excited about. You know, I read them. I got every one of them. But I don't know. It just seemed like it was big and huge and a lot of stuff going on, but nothing that really... I did like the Captain America, although some of the characters like Arnim Zola really freaked me out. You know, and the Mad Bomb. It just seemed like it was gross and uncomfortable. All it tells me is Jack Kirby didn't want to go back to Marvel.
Yeah, it's...
No,
yeah.
I'm saying that.
You know, I mean, you could say here and say, like, the biggest mistake Jack did was leave Marvel, and the biggest mistake Marvel did was let Jack go because of creator ownership of characters or whatever. And I think it's both, you know? But I think the 60s, I think by 1970s, obviously the 60s were over, but... I think that magic was gone after that, even though there was some good stuff. I mean, there was good artists that came afterwards, artists that I love just as much as any other guys, and musicians or whatever. I think the magic ended in the 60s, in 1970 or whatever.
That's what Alan Moore says in A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah.
The 60s were a beautiful time, and then it stopped. And then all of a sudden, in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, when they came back, it was in the 80s when it was all punk rock, and at the end of the 70s everything was all down. But I don't know. I honestly,
I love the early 70s. I love what was happening with all the Jones, Kaluta, Wrights, and, you know, Starlin, all the new guys coming up doing all these great books. But the guys that, like, really, like, blew your mind when they came back, it was like either they were running, either they were getting to end of their careers, or in Kirby's case, it was the dream was over, as John Lennon would say. I don't know.
Well, you know, I honestly think, and that's
or it
what
could have been me.
I hear people say this all the time. They should have gave Jack Kirby a part of ownership in the company he helped create.
That would have been nice, but...
And, you know, if he had, he wouldn't have left Marvel, and they would have been stronger.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course they would have. Of course they would. All the new gods would have been created within Marvel's universe and probably marketed a whole lot better than DC did. I think part of it was that DC didn't know what to do with this stuff, you know?
Well, I've heard rumor. On another interview, Neil Adams was talking about his books weren't selling. So DC said, well, but Neil Adams' covers sell really well. So they put him on covers, which he did really well on that, and I liked his covers. But Neil Adams says the reason why there was all these people that were sandbagging, you know, the returns, the distributors. They were sandbagging on Neil Adams' comics because he was finding all these mint condition back issues that were supposedly sent back to DC, and they never were. And he says that his books would have sold really well, but they were bagging everything he did. But the covers.
What do you mean by bagging? You have to explain that.
Well, they were basically pulling them out, taking credit for sending them back, and not putting them out in the stands, and selling them on the secondary market.
Wow.
This is what Neil Adams says, and he always allocates to. Now, I've heard John Workman talk about a friend of his swears that Jack Kirby's Fourth World series, which didn't sell well, the reason why was they were doing the same thing. That the distributors were pulling those, thinking that they were going to be worth something, and they were sandbagging them and selling them on the secondary market.
Oh, man.
And he said if they would have hit the stands, all of them, it would have sold and done well. But John Workman, when he says that, he says, I don't know if I subscribe to that one.
Yeah, because I got to tell you, I saw all of them in the stands. It wasn't like they were hard to find.
I saw them all the time in the stands. I bought them. I like Mr. Miracle. I wanted to get the New Gods, but I rarely saw it. I kept seeing a Mr. Miracle and Forever People. The Forever People, I honestly didn't care for that much. And new Jimmy Olsen was everywhere. You know?
Yeah, Jimmy Olsen was everywhere. I remember seeing all four of them. I remember buying the first issue of all four of them when they came out.
So, you know, I mean, there were neat things to it. And towards the end, I noticed he wasn't putting as much effort in them as he was in the beginning. So.
No.
But
not at all, no. You're right.
But, you know, you're talking about marketing. Marvel would have marketed the books. That was another thing in this book. They were talking about the Epic line of comics. Jim Starlin started it off, and one thing he found real quick was...
Dreadstar?
Yeah, Dreadstar. That was the first of the Epic Comics line. But he said that was the big problem, was that they weren't... Jim Starlin found that Marvel wasn't promoting and marketing the books for Epic if you owned it yourself. And none of those books really, you know, most of Dreadstar lasted for a long time, and then he took it to First Comics.
Yeah.
And but a lot of those books ended after 8 issues. Time Spirits, Starstruck, you know, they were about 8 issues. Groove.
Coyote lasted a while.
Yeah, Coyote lasted a while, and then...
Groove lasted a while.
Groove, they did 120 issues.
Oh, God, that's
awesome.
Think
about it.
That's awesome.
They did something like...
Oh, wow.
Seven or eight issues of Pacific Comics, and one issue with Eclipse, and then went to Epic and did 120 regular issues, plus a graphic novel, and then they repackaged the Pacific Comics stuff with another story that they did in Epic Illustrated. Then he went to Image and did 12 issues of Image.
God.
And then he went to... Dark Horse that started a miniseries. I think he did probably 8 4-issue miniseries and a special issue. A lot of work.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, they always talk about Jack Kirby's 102 run of penciling and, you know, plotting Fantastic Four was always the record. Everybody always tried to beat. But Dave Sim did 300 issues of Cerebus, and he basically did everything except towards the end, another Gerhard started.
Gerhard did a whole lot.
Yeah, I guess halfway through the run.
Yeah. But, more than that. Gerhard did a whole lot.
Yeah, and beautifully. Quite
and
beautifully.
And beautifully, yeah.
Well, Sergio Gonzalez, Stan Sakai lettered the books, and a guy named Gordon Kent started to color them, and then later Tom Luth colored them.
Yep.
And Mark Evanier plotted the books with Sergio and wrote them. And so, I mean, there was other guys, but Sergio Arganez was penciling and inking all those issues grew.
And working for Matt, too, wasn't he at the time?
Yeah, he never stopped working for Matt. That's just unfathomable.
Amazing.
Well, they said when he started talking about the margins and had those little marginal cartoons, they didn't want to do it. And they said, well, you can't come up with this many. You know, he goes, no, I can't. He says, all right, look, we'll run what you gave us. And when you want to bring in some others, we'll run them. But, you know, when you run out of ideas, that'll be it. Well, Sergio Ganez laughs about it, saying, I never ran out of ideas. He never did. But, you know, that's something. Because when I was reading Gru, and that's one of my, still to this day, one of my favorite comics. When I think comics, I think Gru, and it makes me happy. But, you know, when he was doing those issues with Pacific, the first couple of years, man, these are something. They were big epics. You know, I loved how he'd walk around these cities, and they had these big castles. I think the second issue, he's walking through a city, and on the top floors, there's these women with no shirts on, waving. And you can see they were, you know, prostitutes. It was a very colorful world he built, and all the little bags people had, and the ornaments, and the jars, and swords everywhere, lizards, food people were cooking. And I remember the first, I guess it's about the fourth issue, I thought, well, that's another good story. But he's, you know, going to be run out of ideas soon. And I know that they joked that they still only had 5 jokes in Gru. They always said mulch. You know, he always said, did I err? You know, and he's slow of mind. And later he says, what do you mean by that? You know, I mean, there's always stuff like that. But it never stopped. They had me from every single issue. And when Dark Horse puts out another Gru issue, I go get it.
Of course.
It's just staggering.
I know. The guy's amazing. I mean, it's like, No loss of energy as far as, like, you know.
But he worked for Matt for, what, 50 years?
Oh, God,
I think he did at least 16 of those marginal cartoons in every issue. 50 years, that's a monthly book, 16 cartoons, besides all of the center spreads and all that. And that was
an amazing accomplishment.
Well, that's one thing you talk about was Don Martin. I guess they did an absolute of all of his Mad work in a book, which, oh, you have it?
I have like the four, that's all of Don Martin's work for Matt up there.
Well, they always talk about doing Sergio Ganez, and he said, well, yeah, and he brought up the Don Martin book, and but they said, I didn't know you had that. I want to look.
Dude, you know what a score that was? My friend told me about it. I went to Barnes & Noble, and I got it for $25. It was $150 four-volume book. Oh,
it's worth $150. He's the man. I love Don Martin.
Yeah, he's living in South Florida, too. My friend interviewed him when he was a kid.
but that's one thing Sergio Ganez said, was that all the work he did for Mad, you know, it was just, it'd be a bigger than an encyclopedia set.
Oh, God, really?
Well, encyclopedia sets, for those of you born after the 90s.
Yeah.
School libraries had them. A lot of people had them in the home, but it would be like, you know, 16 to 20 books. Really nice book with a really nice binding, glossy pages. The ones my family had was in the 50s, and it was the black and white, you know, with grayscales. But later they had color ones, but it was an encyclopedia, basically.
World Book Encyclopedia.
Yeah, had everything.
I had the encyclopedia.
I remember my favorite was, at one point, they had myths, and they had Robin Hood. And they had an N.C. Wyeth book cover of Robin Hood being taught by his dad how to shoot a bow. And underneath the caption said, there's been so many stories told of Robin Hood, nobody's sure if he's a myth or reality. And I thought, wow, that's something. You know, you looked up Zebra, it was in there. You looked up Mozart, he was in there.
According to Jesse Marsh, he never went to college or anything like that, but he was well-read, well-educated man. He said, they asked him, how'd you learn all this? He goes, he read the entire Encyclopedia Britannica from beginning to end.
Well, there you go. I guess they don't even make those anymore.
Can you buy CD-ROM.
Oh, you can buy CD-ROMs?
Pretty sure.
So even CD-ROMs to me seem antique now.
Remember when the guys used to come to your house and knock on your door?
Yeah.
That's how I got mine. It's just like door-to-door salesmen or whatever.
Yeah, we had a bunch.
I wish they still had it. You know, one of our moves, I tossed them. You know, we had, and they kept coming up with yearbooks every year. They would send you a yearbook, 71, 2, 3, 4, 5. For a while, we just stopped getting them.
Like I said, the one we had, it was an older one, and I remember
Well, now the internet is your encyclopedia. Yeah. What am I talking about?
Well, yeah, it's a different thing, but yeah, it's God, man, the world changed so quickly, you know?
Yeah.
Well, they were even advertising those in the 80s, the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Funkin' Wagnalls?
Yeah.
World Book Encyclopedia,
That's right. And
yeah.
So, they were nice. Anyway, how do we get on this subject? What were we talking about?
Sergio Aragonés's artwork could fill it. It's an entire encyclopedia.
That's something. And he was another one that always worked for DC Comics. And then,
He created
Batlash.
Batlash, yeah.
He did a lot of plans for horror books.
He wrote horror comics, too, yeah.
And then it was when Paul Levitz had
Plop.
The...
Plop, he worked in Plop
magazine. Yeah, well, that was his book.
Yeah, Plop.
His argument with Plop was he had the idea and he had people set up to work in it, and then DC insisted they use their people, and they said the problem was they weren't funny, you know.
Some of them were somewhere. He had brought back Wolverton to do one of the covers.
And later Wally Wood started.
Wally Wood was doing an incredible Wolverton imitation later on. I was like, at first I was like, well, they got Wolverton back. It was Wally Wood. I was like, damn, dude.
Yeah, well, I did like Plop. It was because of Sergio Aragonés is why I loved it the most. But yeah, it was a good book. But he always told the story that Paul Levitz had a check, but he had to sign the work for hire. And Sergio Aragonés wouldn't do it, and Paul Levitz tore the check up in front of him, and he never worked for him again.
Oh, man.
And then on the first issue of Gru, he said he had the idea for Gru for a long time, and I've always heard that he was always drawing that character in sketchbooks and sometimes even convention sketches. And the first time they ever put Gru in was that Destroyer Duck. That was Steve Gerber and Jack Kirby.
That's right, the backup.
And that's why I bought the book, was for that. I thought that was just fantastic. And then when Pacific Comics came out, he did it for them. But when the first issue grew, he had a whole write-up about how he did work for these other people. But they wouldn't let you own it, and that meant something to him. He says, now that we got these places like Pacific, now they're all giving you ownership and royalties. Amazing, no?
Except for Marvel and DC.
Well, they had a royalty program, which made all the Image guys really rich.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Ownership, not so much.
Well, one thing about, you know, getting on that is the Image guys, it was editorial was starting to happen. And I guess they started, I think it's when Jim Shooter was booted, they started offering incentives and royalties to the editors. And that was one thing that started making things go irate, because the editors were trying to make as much money as they could. And that's why Spider-Man and Wolverine was appearing in every single story.
Oh, God, yeah.
And, you know, that's when things started going kind of out of whack, because they weren't thinking of making comics and stories. They were trying to...
Here's an interesting one. Do you remember around the time in the early 80s when, like, I think this is the right word, when the comic book started to have a lot of overlays?
What do you mean?
Okay. Say you have, like, you know, the main page, and then you have, like, a special effect in the background that it was overlaid over it, like in a different kind of gradation. You got paid extra money for those overlays. Say you drew like the regular superhero scene, and if you want to do an overlay with a special effect or something to go behind it or behind it, you get paid another page rate, the same page rate.
I didn't know that.
As another page. So that's why that was going on for a while there, because Marvel was like going like, it pays as an extra page or whatever, you know. Wow. So, yeah, that was going on a little bit in the 80s, and then they put a stop to that.
It's
all computerized anyway, so who cares, you know.
After they destroyed the whole industry.
I think DC helped destroy the industry pretty much.
Well, I mean,
them and that Heroes World distribution.
That wasn't DC, Marvel
started. Yeah, no,
that.
That's what I mean. Yeah, DC did with the deaths of Superman. And then that Heroes World thing kind of, you know, that's a whole nother story for, you know. I was out of comics at that point. I wasn't working for the, I wasn't running the comic shop. So I only hear things about it. I never had to deal with it.
They do talk about it in the book. They build up and build up. Then it gets to the death of Superman. But I feel like a music break again. What's it going to be, buddy?
All right. Well, I'm not going to say in tribute to the times that were going on, but we're going to play the Stranglers, one of our favorite punk bands, with a Nuclear Device.
There you go.
First and last man walked this earth, but only a few survive. I'm the Wizard of Oz, and
Stranglers, Nuclear Device, commentary on modern times.
There you go. And they just keep changing.
Yeah.
Well, I'm tired of butchering this really good book I'm reading, so when I finish it, I'll loan it to you, and then in a couple of years, we can talk about it again.
No, that's going to be my book to read for when we do the sharing of books again.
No, because I already got one for you.
Okay.
So this one's just, it's extra credit.
Extra credit? Oh, my God. Okay.
That's why I'm giving you a couple of years.
All right, so what else we got?
Well, I'm sitting here. I walked in here, and the first thing I said before you started the show was Al's got an illustration magazine, and it's Peter Holly, and it is staggering. Talk about it.
Well, I mean, Illustration Magazine came out about 5-6 years ago, and it's basically about all the old artists, mostly advertising artists, that did like either magazine covers like the men's magazines, or they did the paperback covers like the Mickey Spillane's or whatever. Pretty much, with the exception of maybe like Frazetta and a few others, guys that we would never know who they were. And this magazine is pretty much responsible for in educating people about all these great artists. And every issue, it's like a $15 book. But it comes bagged, or it used to come bagged. The latest one didn't. But it's in full color. It's hardcover stock, and it's probably the most beautiful book out there that you can get for just beautiful drawings. A lot of it is, you know, I mean, some of the stuff is lurid. You know, like the guys who did those, you know, Stag magazines or whatever, you know, but they drew so beautifully that it makes it kind of like almost okay. You know, you don't feel that you got to take a bath or anything after reading about Ilsa, the She-Wolf of the SS, or anything like that, you know. But, yeah, this is definitely like the best magazine about that. There are some British ones that are coming out. I think they're called one's called Illustrator. I forgot what the other one is, and they're about the British illustrators from the same era, but those are like $25 each. It's like, oh, I gotta draw the line somewhere, yeah. You know. I mean, 15 is high enough for me.
Well, I remember these in magazines. So you'd always see, you know, painted things: Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Pepsodent toothpaste,
yeah, sure, yeah.
Maiden Form bras.
Yeah.
But photography slowly started coming in, which is nice too. And I guess now it's just all completely photography,
yeah,
and text.
Sure it is, yeah.
But I think illustration started disappearing in the late 80s and early 90s. But Peter Hawley, I never knew who he was, but you could always tell the work. It always looked like it was backlit. He was always so bright. Not always, but like that image on the cover right there.
Yeah, the light source is from like above here, and it's like, you know, yeah.
But it just, there's a live journal group where people scan in old magazine ads. A lot of them are illustrated, but they don't say who they are. On Facebook, there's Mark Wheatley, the cartoonist, has a really nice page, illustrator's page, and Shane Glines, on his page, he's always putting up all these illustrators, and they say who they are. That's where I learned who Peter Hawley was. I said, oh, that's that guy. He always did paintings, but there were some where there were colored illustrations, you know, like, you know, two tones, you know, black and a mauve and stuff.
Yeah, duotone. Yeah.
And my God, he could be really graphic too, you know.
Oh, really? Wow.
I mean, not graphic like Sax and stuff. I mean, graphic like
stark and powerful.
Yes.
Yeah,
you know, kind of modern looking, which I Peter Hawley's one of my favorites. So, of course, you have the magazine and know all about him.
I don't know all about him. I haven't read the article yet. You're the one who knows more about it than I do. I know more about the magazine than I do about Peter Hawley. The thing about these guys is some of them have very similar styles, though.
Yeah.
There was an advertising look back then, the girls. But, damn it, these guys drew the most beautiful women ever. So,
absolutely.
And that's the thing. I don't care if you're like a, you know, an average artist. If you can draw a beautiful woman, I'm buying your book, damn it. Yeah.
It's a friend of mine always brings up all the time about movie posters and TV guide illustrations. And one thing he brings up is Bob Peek.
Bob Peek, yeah, he did a lot of TV guide covers. Yeah.
Well, you know, the one thing, I think he did the first Star Trek, or maybe it was Star Trek 2, the poster
maybe
for
Star
Wrath
Wars.
Of Khan. No, it was other people.
It was Star Trek, okay. Yeah.
But, you know, it had the colored lines going through with the faces of, you know, Spock and
Captain. Yeah.
Just absolutely staggering. I loved it. And what was the guy, Amsel, that did a lot of movie posters?
Yeah, Amsel, yeah.
Now it's all just images of the movie. And sometimes that can be okay, but I love these guys when they did that kind of illustration work. And it brought out something to just seeing the movie, you know, the cover image.
There was a charm to it. Well, you know what they did? This is really interesting. When it was a B movie, like Attack of the 50-Foot Woman,
right,
or anything like that. The guy, what's his face? Reynolds Brown, who did, like, there was a documentary about him called The Man Who Drew.
Yeah, we talked about that in
Monsters.
The past episode.
His job was to sell the movie.
Right.
The movie, the poster was shown to distributors to buy the movie. And when all the drive-in said, yeah, we'll take it. As soon as they knew, okay, we're going to have it running in every drive-in in the U.S. All right, what do we do now? Okay, get Roger Corman to make the movie for $20,000. So that's how it worked. It was the opposite.
Yeah.
It was the poster came first, and then the movie showed up. And then people would just go to see the movie because it was like the TV was hardly, you know, it was popular, but it wasn't what it is now. And, you know, it was kids would go to the drive-ins or whatever. So these guys were really responsible for selling all the products, you know, all the paperback cover guys is I keep forgetting people's names or whatever. Anyway, he's
Saul
the guy.
Bass.
What's that?
Saul Bass.
No, Saul Bass was the guy who did the Psycho, the titles for the
He had a really stark graphic style that I just loved.
Robert McGinnis, one of my second favorite paperback artists. He's the guy who drew the most beautiful, sophisticated-looking women in all the Mickey Spillane, Brett Halsey.
He had that on Destination Nightmare.
Yeah, I love him, man. I love Robert McGinnis. He's one of my... And he's still around, I think. And the only thing that was a letdown for him after there's a documentary about him, and it showed him like drawing. The only thing that let me down about him, and it's just a minor quibble, he traced the figure of the woman from the Capote. He would use a model, trace the figure, but what he did after the tracing is amazing, and he did it in egg tempera. Which is like he mixes the paint in like egg yolk, and so he was doing it in some like old style, you know, concoction of paint or whatever. But you know, after the tracing, the sketching is done, what he does is genius or whatever. So
well,
Robert McGinnis.
That's I guess he traced. He's still doing work over it. So.
Yeah, I mean, he's still giving life to it or whatever, but, you know, it just kind of went, okay, whatever, you know. It still doesn't stop me from loving these beautiful covers because there's a lot more to them than just the two figures or whatever.
Well, I couldn't do it, so.
Yeah.
I couldn't trace it and make it look that good.
So anyway, hey, man, you know, we're up to, like, you know, over close to 2 hours, so we might as well.
Super episode.
Super duper two-man episode, so we might as well call it a day.
All right. Well, one thing I can't recommend if you are into comics, you read them all this time, Marvel Comics, The Untold Story by Sean Howe.
Yeah, definitely.
Is absolutely on a recommended list. I can't wait to finish this.
The only problem with that book is no pictures.
Yeah, there's no pictures, which is kind of surprising. Usually when you get a prose book like this, and it'll have two sections with some shots, you can see who they were. But honestly, I don't miss that.
No, it's a lot of info.
On the inside, I guess it's the first page or so, they got a little narrow ad for Marvel Comics, a little tiny strip. And at the very back of the comic, it has a picture of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby together.
Yeah.
That is one thing I want to close the show with. Jack Kirby was on a radio show in New York. I guess this is in the early 90s. And Stan Lee called in on the show. And, you know, they talked for a while. But it was kind of warm. You know, I never thought, because there was a lot of aggravation between. And Stan Lee said something about Jack, you were the best. And Jack said, you know, it's really nice work. He kept calling Stanley.
Wow.
And it says, it was nice working with you. And then Stan Lee went on about just what a genius Jack Kirby was, and then he waited for Jack Kirby to, you know, say the same thing. And Jack Kirby said, well, you put really good words in my stories. And, you know, there was like an awkward silence, and then Stan Lee thanked him for that. And I think they met somewhere else, and that was the whole thing. It was an argument. And it brought up, but Stan Lee never argued with that. Every time he said, all you did was just lay the words over our stories. And Stan Lee, you know, I hear Stan Lee say, you know, in Hollywood, Glenn Larson says, I've got this idea for something. All these people work on it, but he's still credited as the creator of the show. And he said, comics is the only thing where somebody doesn't do that. Well, my argument was, you have a vague idea of something, and one person goes in and builds the whole strip. That's a little different than Hollywood, you know, if you have a whole crew of people doing it. But anyway, it's really good, and I'm really happy that there was some warmth between the two, you know, so even if it's just a little bit.
And on that note, well, you know what? Well, before we go, we should fond farewells to Carmen Infantino.
I love Carmen Infantino. I loved his Flash. I liked it when he drew Batman. Again, he had this stark, clear line style I loved. I guess when he was the publisher of DC, or the big kahuna there, he didn't draw too much. And
He ended up drawing a few stories for Warren, believe it or not, a few years later.
Well, you posted those.
I posted a couple
Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, I've mentioned it before. I cannot stress to you, it's on a sidebar of the blog. Go to it. Rock bands, all kinds of horror
B-movies,
comic books. He has got it all. He's covered it, and you post at an unbelievable rate, and you changed that banner and the look of that blog quite
yeah,
a
I
bit.
Did.
And it just, I loved every incarnation of the look.
Yeah. And it's nice to be able to, you know, give a little shout-out tribute to Carmen Infantino.
I love Carmen Infantino. I loved it when he left DC and went to Marvel and was doing Spider-Woman, even though he was from North.
Yeah, Spider-Woman.
It seemed to me he was a little out of practice, but I still loved him.
The artist who created the writer with Don DeCarlo who created Sabrina.
I can't remember his name. Was it Whirly? I just read about it on Facebook.
Oh God.
Yeah, Sabrina the Teenage Witch was credited to this writer and Dan DeCarlo, like Al and I kind of wondered about in the past.
And he just passed away.
He just passed away.
Let's see, Sabrina. Okay, another guy who passed away was one of the mad artists, Bob Clark. You remember his work?
No.
He used to do a lot of the covers for Mad Magazine. He did a lot of advertising work, but he did a lot of the covers for Mad Magazine. He was like in his late 80s too. He just passed away.
The cover artists, unless they signed the names, I didn't know.
Yeah. It was Bob Clark. There was a guy called Norman Mingo, I think, did a lot of work. Oh, God, what was the other one? There was another guy that did a lot of work for him. But, yeah, Bob Clark, who did, he did interior pages, too. And he was like, whatchamacallit. He was great. He hadn't worked in years, and I just saw that he passed away. I was kind of bummed out about
that. I'm sorry about that.
Let's see. Jess Franco. The B-movie director, God, from like the 60s all the way through recently. I mean, his work was better in the 60s than it was after. In the 70s, he got really into explicit stuff, and I don't think it was as good, but he definitely influenced a lot of directors, and he did over 200 movies, directed 200 movies, so you got to give him props for that.
Wow.
Yeah. And Jonathan Winters yesterday.
Yeah, I just heard he passed away.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, you got to give George Gladier was the writer.
Oh, okay, George Gladier and Dan DeCarlo.
Sabrina was created by George Gladier and Dan DeCarlo. So, yeah, he just passed away.
And they never got any credit or ownership.
They never got, you know, Dan DeCarlo never got... credit or anything like that for
Well, I guess he was credited, but you know, like when they did the Sabrina cartoon shows, he never got anything, and they had that ABC sitcom for
that's
a few
right.
years.
That's right. Yeah,
again, that's but I don't think he ever sued him for Sabrina.
No, for Josie he did.
But he created that one outright. I'm guessing that the writer created the strip and he just drew it for him. But I may be wrong.
All right, well, on that note,
anyway,
we better hit the road. So, all right, you know, be good, do all that good stuff.
Oh, also, you can find us on iTunes.
Yeah, that's right.
Write us an iTunes review. There is an issue with iTunes right now, and I can't figure out what the problem is, but it'll be fixed. You can find our blog at bunchofdorks.com, and then click on the Cyclops. Thank you, Al.
Click on the Cyclops.
And you can also hear our sister
Slow
podcast
Robot-a-go-go.
With Mal and Dr. Mobius from Parts Unknown.
Which I will be, after this, I will be going and doing one of those.
Oh, there you go. So also, you can read Dallas's comic, The Mighty Blue. All this is on the sidebar of our blog.
Dr. Bah.
Dr. Bah, yeah, at work, that's what he's being called now.
Dr. Bah.
Also, check out Slice Radio. I went there today, and again, I heard my friend, even though he didn't tell me anything about it, and they got a lot of material on there.
Yeah. Slice Radio rules. Especially when we'll just keep it quiet. We'll see what happens.
Anyway, that's all we got.
And then remember, read
more
comics.